Imagine you're moving like millions of dollars of stock for a company that burns daily horoscopes into your morning toast.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. It's chaotic.
Yeah.
It's high stakes. And one wrong signature on a single contract means you aren't just fired.
Right.
Like the SEC is literally freezing your firm's bank accounts
yeah.
and knocking on your front door.
Right. And nobody wants that.
No one wants that. So today, we're going on a rescue mission to make sure that does not happen to you.
Because your Series 79 exam is looming, and we are tackling a massive, just incredibly testable beast today.
Yeah.
Underwriting syndicate activities.
Right. But real quick, before we jump into the deep end,
yeah.
This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. Look, studying for fun in our exams is a grind. We all know it. But they have this full Series 79 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It actually adapts to what you know and what you don't know, which saves you so much time. You can check it out at certfuel.com. So, okay, let's unpack this topic. Why is this specific area such a monster on the exam?
Well, to frame the stakes here, this unit is a huge chunk of your score. It falls under Function 2, which makes up 27% of the entire test.
Wow. Over a quarter.
Exactly. What we are doing today is we're breaking down the hidden architecture of a public offering. Like, we are going to look at the plumbing behind the walls.
Yeah.
Who actually takes the financial risk? Who gets paid? And honestly, most importantly, how do you avoid the wrath of federal regulators when you're moving astronomical sums of money around?
And because, you know, staring at a textbook wall of text about regulatory filings is just a guaranteed way to fall asleep.
Oh, absolutely.
And I know my own attention span definitely cannot handle that. We're going to use a story to make this stick today. We have a recurring cast of characters.
Okay, I love this.
First up, we have Frank the founder.
Frank.
Frank is ambitious. He's a little bit naive. And he has just created an AI-powered toaster oven company called AI Toast. Yeah, burns your bread based on your astrological sign and predicts if you'll have a bad day. It is totally ridiculous. It's somehow brilliant. And Frank wants to take it public. He wants an IPO.
Which brings us to our second character. This is lead manager Larry.
Right.
Larry works at a major investment bank. He hasn't slept a full 8 hours since like 2018.
Just mainlining coffee.
Exactly. He is the stressed out main underwriter who is holding the master plan, and he's just trying to get Frank's weird toaster company onto the stock exchange without losing his job or his firm's capital.
And finally, rounding out the trio, we have desperate dealer Dan.
Ah, Dan.
Dan is a small-time broker at this tiny regional firm. He drives a beat-up sedan, he drinks lukewarm break room coffee, and he literally just wants to sell some AI Toast shares to his retail clients for a quick fee.
He absolutely refuses to take on a single ounce of actual risk. Like, he's just here for the commission check.
Yep.
So we have Frank, Larry, and Dan. The team is forming. But Larry can't possibly sell millions of shares of AI Toast all by himself, right? Like, how does he actually orchestrate this army of brokers?
Well, he builds a public offering syndicate. A syndicate is essentially this temporary alliance of broker-dealers who band together for one specific deal.
Just one.
Right, just this one IPO. They share the heavy lifting of marketing the shares, they share the economic rewards, and crucially, they share the inventory risk. But to hold this very fragile alliance together, Larry uses two distinct master documents. And the exam will test your ability to tell them apart.
Okay.
The first is the agreement among underwriters, known as the AAU.
Yeah.
The second is the selected dealer's agreement.
Okay, I love a good analogy to keep things straight, especially for something this dry. Let's picture a massive restaurant operation.
Okay.
The AAU is the contract for the kitchen staff. Larry is the executive head chef, and he hires a bunch of sous chefs.
Those are the other syndicate members. They sign the AAU. They are pooling their money to buy the raw ingredients, they're cooking the food, and they are taking the financial risk if the food goes bad and nobody shows up to eat. They're in the kitchen, sweating over the stoves.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. The AAU defines the relationship between the heavy hitters taking the risk. And then you have the selected dealer's agreement.
Right.
In your restaurant analogy, that's your third-party food delivery driver. That's desperate dealer Dan.
Yes. Dan signs the selected dealer's agreement. Think about a delivery driver, right? He only gets paid if he actually delivers a meal to a customer. But he doesn't own the unsold food.
Exactly.
If nobody orders the AI toaster, Dan just shrugs, gets in his beat-up sedan, and goes home. He takes zero inventory risk. If the food rots, it's not his problem.
That distinction between risk-takers and non-risk-takers is incredibly important on the 79. Let's look a little deeper at the AAU, the pitch and contract. It's signed by lead manager Larry and all the other participating syndicate members. Yeah. It formally appoints Larry as the lead agent, which gives him the sweeping authority to allocate the issue, set the final price, and manage the syndicate pot, which is just the pool of money they all share.
Right, the pot.
But this is where the exam tries to get you. When it comes to liability for unsold shares, the liability in the AAU is, quote, several, unquote, not joint.
Hold on, let me push back on that legalese. Several, not joint. What does that actually mean for the guys in the kitchen? Like, if sous chef Bob completely drops the ball, goes on a bender, and can't sell his allotment of AI Toast shares, Larry isn't legally on the hook for Bob's failure.
Legally, no. Several liability means each individual underwriter is strictly liable only for their own specific pre-agreed pro rata share of any unsold securities.
Wow. Okay.
One underwriter's failure does not automatically create a legal obligation for the others to buy those exact shares. Now, the contract itself will usually have a backup mechanism to reallocate those unsold shares among the surviving syndicate members so the deal doesn't collapse.
Because they want it to succeed.
Right, exactly. But it is a contractual term they agreed to, not an automatic baseline legal rule of joint liability. You are legally responsible for your slice of the pie and your slice only.
Wait, if the risk is that high, and if one guy failing means everyone else has to scramble to fix it through reallocation anyway, why sign the AAU at all? Why wouldn't everyone just want to be desperate dealer Dan, take zero risk, and sleep soundly at night?
Oh, because of the economics. The people taking the risk get the lion's share of the money.
Ah, right. Risk and reward.
Always. Syndicate members who sign the AAU get a piece of the actual underwriting fee. The lead manager, Larry, gets a management fee on top of that just for organizing the circus. They're being compensated handsomely for putting their firm's capital on the line. Desperate dealer Dan, on the other hand, only gets the selling concession.
Which is much smaller.
Much, much smaller slice of the total fee because his capital isn't at risk.
Which brings us perfectly to how Dan operates. He signs the selected dealer's agreement. Mm. The rule book says he acts as a principal when he buys the shares he requested, meaning he actually takes title to them for a brief, fleeting moment to resell them to his clients.
Right.
But, and this is huge for the examine, he takes absolutely zero inventory risk on the deal's unsold shares.
Correct. If Dan calls up 10 clients and they all think Horoscope Toast is a terrible investment, those shares revert right back to the syndicate. Dan has no financial liability for the leftover stock. He doesn't have to buy it himself.
Okay, I want everyone listening to just pause and think about this scenario. I'm going to ask a direct question, and I want you to answer it in your head before we reveal it.
I love this.
So, if Dan fails to sell his allocation of AI toasters, who eats the financial loss?
Uh-huh.
You or Larry? Give it a second.
Take a peek.
Answer. Larry and the syndicate eat the loss. Dan's unsold shares revert back to the kitchen. Dan just misses out on his commission check, but he does not lose his shirt.
Nope. And while all this is happening, Larry has to actually run the logistics of the deal. He's managing dozens of firms, millions of shares, and he does this using a wire system. Deal wires.
Right, because they aren't like mailing handwritten letters to each other to coordinate a multi-million dollar IPO.
Exactly. The lead manager establishes what's called a deal ID at the very start of the offering. Think of that deal ID as the master tracking number, like a FedEx tracking number for the entire operation.
Okay.
Wires are sent to the syndicate, to the selling group, and to Finaro.
But I've noticed when reading through the source material, there's a point of confusion here. Not all wires are mandatory regulatory filings, are they?
No, and that's a brilliant distinction to highlight. Some wires are just internal courtesy updates, a registration effectiveness wire, or a closing wire. That's just Larry sending a blast out to the team saying, you know, hey, everyone, the SEC just declared our registration effective. We're good to go. Or, hey, the deal successfully closed. Great job.
Just keeping everyone in the loop.
Exactly. But other wires, specifically the restricted period wire or the pricing wire, those double as mandatory FINRA notifications. Finera uses that deal ID to tie all of those mandatory filings back to Frank's specific offering so they can monitor it.
Okay, so the kitchen is staffed, the delivery drivers are hired, the deal ID is generated. But before Larry can sell a single AI toaster to the public, Larry and Frank have to agree on who is actually holding the ultimate bag if this whole thing flops.
Yeah.
What exactly did Larry promise Frank, the founder?
Right.
Which brings us to the actual legal promise, the underwriting commitments.
The commitment type is the absolute foundation of the deal. It controls who bears the ultimate risk of the unsold shares and whether the underwriter is acting as a principal or an agent. For the exam, the two big ones you need to compare side by side, like no inside and out, are firm commitment and best efforts.
Okay, let's unpack firm commitment first, because this is the big leagues. In a firm commitment, Larry acts as a principal. He looks Frank in the eye, shakes his hand, and promises him a giant guaranteed check.
Huge check.
Yeah. Larry legally commits to buy the entire issue of AI Toast stock at a fixed price from Frank, and then Larry turns around and resells it to the public. Larry and the syndicate hold 100% of the inventory risk. If the public completely rejects the AI toaster, Larry is stuck owning millions of shares of a worthless company.
While Frank is on a beach.
Frank is on a beach, he still gets his money.
Precisely. The industry term for this is proceeds certainty. Frank gets guaranteed proceeds. And because Larry is taking on massive existential risk to his firm's balance sheet, the underwriting fees are much higher.
Naturally.
But this is where the exam tries to get you. When people hear firm commitment, they often imagine Larry hoarding millions of shares of stock in a vault weeks before the offering, just sitting on it while he tries to find buyers.
Yeah, that's exactly how I pictured it at first. Like he buys the inventory wholesale, puts it on shelf, and then runs a marketing campaign.
Right, but that's not how the timeline works in reality. The settlement, the actual moment the syndicate buys the shares from the issuer and pays them the money, happens at the closing date. And closing is typically just a few days after pricing.
Oh, wow.
By the time Larry actually writes that giant check to Frank, the shares are almost entirely pre-sold to institutional and retail investors. The true window of terrifying risk for Larry is just that short 48 to 72 hour period between pricing the deal and closing it.
That is wild.
If a massive macroeconomic event happens in that tiny window and all the buyers back out, that is when Larry is left holding the bag.
That makes total sense. He's not sitting on the risk for months. It's a highly orchestrated flashpoint of risk.
Yeah.
So that's firm commitment. Let's look at the other side of the coin. Best efforts.
Okay.
In a best efforts deal, Larry acts as an agent. He is a broker, not a principal. He just says, Frank, I'll try my absolute best. I'll use my Rolodex. I'll call all my institutional clients. But he has no legal obligation to buy the shares himself with his firm's money. If the shares don't sell, Frank the founder's out of luck. Frank raises less capital, maybe the company goes under, and Larry just collects a smaller fee for whatever small amount he did manage to sell.
In plain best efforts, the issuer bears all the risk. Now, there is a third type that often confuses candidates. Let's talk about the weird cousin of the underwriting world.
The weird cousin.
I like it.
The standby commitment.
Oh, man. I find the standby commitment fascinating because it's a hybrid situation. So let's say Frank isn't doing an IPO. Let's say AI Toast has been public for a few years, but Frank desperately needs cash to build a new factory.
Okay.
He decides to do a rights offering. He offers his current shareholders the special right to buy more AI Toast stock at a discount to the current market price. But Frank is terrified. He's sweating bullets. He says, Larry, what if my current investors don't want more stock? What if they ignore the rights offering? I won't get the money to build the factory. This is where Larry steps in as the hero. Enter the standby commitment. Larry agrees to backstop the rights offering. He promises Frank that whatever shares the current shareholders don't buy the unsubscribed shares, Larry will step in and buy them himself.
Wait, I've seen practice questions on this, and the exam will describe a standby commitment and try to trick you into calling it a best efforts deal because Larry is only taking the quote-unquote leftovers. But it is absolutely not best efforts, right?
Yeah, that's the trap. It is emphatically not best efforts.
Yes.
A standby commitment is a firm commitment on the leftovers. Larry has a principal legal obligation to buy those unsold shares with his own capital.
Because he promised.
Exactly. He is taking on true inventory risk. If a test question describes a standby commitment, always remember. It is a firm commitment, and its sole purpose in the financial ecosystem is to backstop a rights offering for existing shareholders. Don't let them trick you into thinking it's an IPO structure or a best efforts deal.
Okay, so we've established the legal promises firm, best efforts, standby. But how does Frank choose Larry in the first place? How do they meet and agree on these terms? This brings us to the selection process. Competitive bid versus negotiated.
It's important to remember these terms describe the process of selection, not the legal commitment itself. A competitive bid is essentially a blind auction. The issuer publishes a formal notice of sale, and different underwriting syndicates submit sealed bids.
Like bidding on a construction contract.
Very much so. The winner is usually whoever offers the lowest interest cost to the issuer. You see this almost exclusively in the world of municipal general obligation bonds and agency debt. It's highly standardized.
Right. It's a math equation. It's an auction where the lowest cost wins.
Yeah.
You don't need a deep personal relationship to sell a standard municipal bond. But a negotiated process is a long, complex conversation. The issuer pre-selects the underwriter based on their reputation and sector expertise. They sit down in the boardroom, they figure out the price, they structure the tranches, they argue over the fees. It's a relationship.
So let's test this concept in real time.
Okay, listener, pause and think about this. Frank is doing a massive tech IPO for his AI toaster company. Is Larry going to win this deal via a blind competitive auction or a negotiated process? Take a second.
What do you think?
Answer, negotiated. Without a doubt. IPOs require extensive book building, massive cross-country roadshows, and a ton of bespoke marketing. You cannot just do a blind mathematical auction for a company that burns horoscopes into bread. Hmm. It has to be heavily negotiated.
Exactly. If you see an IPO fact pattern on the exam, do not force it into a competitive bid answer.
So wait, breaking news. We have a situation.
Oh no, what did Frank do?
Frank's AI toaster is too weird. During the management roadshow, one of the prototype toasters gained rudimentary sentience.
Oh boy.
And aggressively threatened a major venture capitalist's prize-winning cat.
That's a PR nightmare.
The video went viral. Investors are terrified. The firm commitment we just talked about, yeah, it is completely off the table. Lori refuses to take the inventory risk on a PR disaster. He has to change the deal structure immediately to a contingency offering, which means we have to explore the absolute most testable part of this unit, the SEC rules that govern contingency offering.
Yeah, I love a good pivot. So Larry downgrades the deal. He moves it from a firm commitment to an agent-based structure, specifically an all-or-none deal, also known as AON.
Let's define the two main flavors of contingency offerings first, because they operate slightly differently. AON versus Minimax.
All-or-none is exactly what it sounds like on the tin. It is a binary outcome, pass or fail, 100% or zero. If the total capital raise target is $10 million and Larry hits the phones all month but only raises $9,999,999.
$1 short.
$1 short. The entire deal is canceled. Every single penny is refunded to the investors.
It's ruthless. Completely binary. The other flavor is Minimax. This means the deal needs to hit a specific floor, a minimum threshold, let's say $5 million. If they can just scrape together $5 million, the contingency is satisfied, the deal is safe, it officially closes, and then it can continue to scale up to a maximum ceiling, like $10 million.
And what's fascinating here is how the SEC approaches these contingency deals. We have to look at the history and the mechanics of why the SEC cares so much.
Yeah.
Think about it. If a retail investor gives Larry $10,000 for an AON deal, they are trusting that they will actually get their money back if the deal fails to hit the target. In the Wild West days of penny stocks, brokers would just keep the money or use it to pay their own firm's electric bill while waiting to see if the deal closed.
Oh my gosh, really?
Oh yeah. The SEC doesn't trust Larry's good intentions. They built a two-part trap to protect investors. Two very specific, aggressive rules.
And we need to do a side-by-side breakdown of these two rules, because mixing them up is a guaranteed loss point on the Series 79. We have Rule 1, the prohibited representations rule, and Rule 2, the investor payment rule, sometimes referred to as the 15C2C4 rule, though you really just need to know the mechanics of it.
Let's start with Rule 1, the prohibited representations rule. I want you to remember that this rule polices the words. It polices the label you put on the box. If Larry prints All or None or Minimax on the official offering prospectus, he is making a binding legal representation to the public.
Right. He can't just use those terms as a cheap marketing gimmick to create FOMO.
Sure.
He can't say, oh, it's an exclusive all or none deal, better buy now before it closes. And then when he fails to raise the money, he turns around and says, well, we tried our best, we fell a little short, but we're just going to keep the $8 million we raised anyway and give it to Frank.
The SEC strictly forbids that. The rule says if you use the contingency label, you must refund the money promptly if the exact stated contingency is not met by the specified date. There are no we tried our best excuses, there are no partial closes, and you cannot secretly draft a side contract to get around it. The label itself is a legally enforceable promise to the investor.
So that's the first rule. It polices the words, the marketing. Now let's look at Rule 2, the investor payment rule. If the first rule polices the words, this one polices the money. It dictates exactly how a broker-dealer must physically handle the investor's cash if the deal is anything other than a firm commitment.
The SEC's logic here is incredibly pragmatic. If the deal might fail and Larry might have to refund all that money, the regulators cannot let that cash get tangled up in Larry's everyday business expenses. It's called commingling, and it's a cardinal sin.
Think of it like a casino. Imagine you place a $1,000 bet on roulette. While the wheel is still spinning, the dealer takes your chips and puts them in his own pocket to go pay his mortgage, promising he'll pay you back if you win. You would lose your mind.
Exactly.
That money needs to sit on the table, untouched, until the outcome is decided. That is what the investor payment rule enforces. If there is a contingency like AON or Minimax Larry, must use a separate agent or trustee account, or a written escrow agreement with an unaffiliated bank, he has to lock the cash away so it's untouchable.
And the SEC staff interpretation is very strict about defining unaffiliated. It means a bank that is not legally affiliated with the issuer, Frank, and not affiliated with the broker-dealer, Larry. It has to be a true, objective third party holding the keys.
Why does it matter so much? Because if Larry holds the money in his firm's general account, and his firm suddenly goes bankrupt tomorrow, which happens, that money gets frozen by a bankruptcy court. It becomes part of the bankruptcy estate. The investors might wait years to get pennies on the dollar. But if it's in a third-party escrow account, it's completely safe from Larry's creditors.
That's the key.
Okay, let's test this to make sure it's sticking. Pause and think. Larry decides to hold the $5 million of investor funds in his own firm's general operating account while waiting to see if the Minimax clears. He promises he won't spend a single cent of it. Is this legal? Give it a beat. Answer, absolutely not. It is a massive violation. Commingling defeats the entire purpose of the rule, even if he doesn't spend it. It must be in an unaffiliated escrow or segregated trustee account.
And this brings us to a major exam trap. The biggest mistake junior underwriters make, and the thing regulators love to bust them on in exams, is misunderstanding the trigger for this rule.
This is where it gets incredibly nuanced. The trigger for the investor payment rule is any distribution other than a firm commitment.
Right, so let's apply that logic. Think about a plain vanilla best efforts deal. There is no all or none contingency. There is no Minimax. It's just Larry trying his absolute best to sell whatever shares he can, and Frank keeps whatever money is raised. Does the strict investor payment rule still apply?
Yes, it absolutely does. But, and this is the key difference you have to memorize, it uses a slightly different path. Because there is no contingency, it doesn't require the strict formal escrow account at an unaffiliated bank. It just uses the promptly transmit path.
Yeah, exactly.
When Larry gets a check from an investor, he must promptly transmit that money directly to Frank the issuer. He can't hold it. The contingency label is what forces you down this strict escrow path. But any non-firm commitment triggers the broader rule that Larry cannot hold the money in his own accounts.
That is a phenomenal summary. The prohibited representations rule is triggered by the label, AON or Minimax. The investor payment rule is triggered by the structure. Anything that isn't a firm commitment. Keep those triggers separate in your mind and you will ace those questions.
All right, so despite the CAD incident, the deal is surviving. We've got the contingency money safely locked in an unaffiliated escrow account, but the SEC is still watching. In fact, they are watching the stock price like a hawk to ensure Frank and Larry don't artificially pump it up before the deal prices. Which brings us to a critical regulatory framework. We need to talk about Regulation M and how we keep the price honest.
Regulation M is the SEC's comprehensive anti-manipulation regime. To understand why it exists, you have to understand the mechanics of market manipulation. If you are a syndicate about to sell a massive block of new stock to the public at $20 a share, you have a huge economic incentive to go into the open market right before pricing and secretly buy up existing shares.
Oh, because that drives the price up.
Exactly. By buying aggressively, you artificially drive the market price up to $25. Then you price your new deal at $20. Retail investors look at the ticker, see 25, and think they're getting an amazing bargain at 20. But once the deal closes and you start artificially pumping the stock, the price collapses and the new investors get crushed.
It's a classic pump mechanism. So RegM was created to step in and say, no, you are restricted from bidding on or purchasing the stock during a specific window right before pricing. And RegM applies to two distinct groups, and they are treated very differently by the SEC. Group one, the distribution participants. That's the syndicate. Larry, Dan, the broker-dealers executing the deal. Group two, the issuers and selling shareholders. That's Frank the founder and his venture capital backers.
Let's look at how the rule treats Larry versus how it treats Frank. For distribution participants, Larry and Dan, there is a massive, highly testable carve-out. It's called the actively traded exception.
Okay, let's unpack why this exception exists. If a stock is truly massive, if it trades millions of shares an hour like water, It's incredibly hard for one rogue broker-dealer to manipulate the price. It would cost billions of dollars to move the needle. So the SEC says, if your stock has an average daily trading volume, an ADTV of at least $1 million, and a public float of at least $150 million, the syndicate gets a free pass. No restricted period at all.
And just to clarify the jargon for a second, the ADTV is just how much the stock trades on an average day. The public float is the total value of all shares that are actually available to trade by the general public. So it specifically excludes shares locked up by insiders like Frank. The SEC's logic makes perfect sense. The manipulation risk is diluted by the sheer size and deep liquidity of the market. But this is where the exam tries to get you.
Okay, lay it on us.
The actively traded exception only applies to the distribution participants. Frank, the founder, the issuer, never gets the actively traded carve-out.
Wait, hold on. If that's true, it feels inconsistent. If the stock is a massive, highly liquid, mega-cap company, shouldn't Frank get the same free pass that Larry gets? Why is the SEC punishing the founder?
Because Frank's economic incentive to manipulate his own stock is absolute, regardless of how big the company is. He is the one raising the money. He benefits directly and permanently from a higher price in a way that Larry doesn't. Larry is just earning a fee. Frank is building his net worth. So the SEC says, regardless of how liquid the stock is, the issuer and selling shareholders are inherently too conflicted. They never get the pass. They are always restricted.
That is such a good distinction to understand the why behind the rule. So if a company doesn't meet that actively traded mega tier, we fall into the restricted period tiers. This is essentially a regulatory timeout. You cannot touch the stock before the pricing happens. There are two tiers you absolutely have to memorize.
Tier one gives you a short, one business day restricted period. To qualify for this lighter penalty box, you need an ADTV of at least $100,000 AND, a public float of at least $25 million.
And tier two is the heavier penalty. It gives you a five business day restricted period. You fall into tier two if you miss either of the tier one thresholds.
Let's do a direct question on this to lock it in.
Okay, listener, pause and think about this one. Frank's stock has a healthy $200,000 ADTV, but it only has a $10 million public float. Does he get the one-day restriction or the five-day restriction? Take a second.
Remember the rule.
Answer, he gets a five-day restriction. You need both thresholds for tier one. His ADTV of 200K was good, but his float of 10 million fell short of the 25 million requirement. If you miss even one metric, you get bumped down to tier two, the five-day penalty box.
And while all this restricted period stuff is happening, Larry has an administrative burden. He has to do the paperwork. FINRA needs to know exactly what's going on so their market surveillance teams can monitor compliance.
Right. Remember the deal ID we talked about in part one? Larry is using that specific ID to file his fee and RA notification. So there are two big ones you need to know for the exam.
Mm-hmm.
First, the restricted period notice. When is Larry required to file that?
The restricted period determination notice is due no later than the business day before the restricted period actually starts. You have to tell FINRA ahead of time, hey, we're going into the penalty box tomorrow. Please update your monitoring systems.
Makes total sense. Proactive disclosure. And the second one is the pricing notice. Once the deal is actually priced and the restriction is lifted, when does Larry have to tell FINRA?
The pricing notice is due no later than the close of business the next business day after pricing.
So notify them the day before the restriction starts and the day after pricing happens. Got it. Okay. The clock ticks down, the restricted period ends, we price the stock, and the deal closes. The AI toaster is officially trading on the public markets. We survived.
But the drama isn't over. In fact, post-pricing mechanics is where some of the most complex interpersonal conflicts happen in underwriting.
Oh, not even close to over.
Yeah.
Frank, the founder, looks at his new net worth on paper. His eyes get wide, and he calls Larry. Larry, this is amazing. I want to immediately sell all my personal insider shares on the open market and buy a 150-foot yacht.
Right, classic Frank.
And at the exact same time, desperate dealer Dan is blowing up Larry's phone, screaming about where his commission check is. Larry has to handle both of them without crashing the stock.
Let's start with Frank in the yacht. This is a classic liquidity event problem. If Frank, the face of the company, dumps all his shares on day one, two things happen. First, the sheer supply of shares floods the market and the stock price craters. Second, the new public investors who just bought in at the IPO price will be absolutely furious because it looks like the founder is abandoning a sinking ship. To prevent this optics and supply disaster, Larry uses lockup agreements.
There are two main types you'll see. The issuer lockup, which legally stops the company itself from issuing brand new shares for a while and diluting the market. and the shareholder lockup, which stops insiders like Frank, his VC backers, his early employees, from dumping their existing shares on the open market.
The typical industry standard for an IPO shareholder lockup is 180 days, roughly 6 months where Frank cannot touch his stock.
So we've talked a lot about the SEC enforcing rules. What does this all mean for the SEC? Is the SEC sitting there in Washington mandating this 180-day rule to protect retail investors?
This is honestly the biggest trick on the test. The SEC does not mandate lockups.
Wait, really? Given how strict they are about everything else.
Really? Yeah. Lockups are 100% private commercial contracts negotiated between lead manager Larry and Frank. The SEC fundamentally doesn't care if the lockup is 180 days, 90 days, 365 days, or 0 days. The SEC only requires one thing: that whatever the terms of the lockup are, they must be explicitly disclosed in the public prospectus. The SEC enforces market transparency, not the specific terms of the private contract themselves.
So if an exam question asks what the regulatory minimum duration is for a lockup, the answer is there isn't one. It's just an industry convention. Okay, so Frank is locked up via private contract. But what happens if he really, really wants that yacht? I've seen the terms cliff and waiver. What's the difference?
The cliff is the hard expiration date of the contract. On day 181, the lockup expires, the cliff is reached, and all those insider shares can legally flood the open market. A waiver, however, is discretionary. A waiver is Larry graciously telling Frank, okay, fine, I see the stock is performing well. I will waive the contract and let you sell 5% of your shares early so you can buy a smaller yacht.
And who holds the power to grant that waiver? Frank or Larry?
Typically the lead manager. Larry usually holds the waiver power, not the issuer.
Because Larry's the one trying to protect the fragile stock price he just worked so hard to build. If Frank had the power, he'd waive himself on day two. Okay, so Frank is handled, he's locked up, maybe he gets a waiver, but he's under control. Now what about desperate dealer Dan? Dan is looking for his money. This brings us to selling agreement disclosure.
FINRA has strict rules about how compensation is documented. They require that the master agreements, the AAU and the selected dealers agreement, explicitly write out the public offering price, or at least a clear formula for determining it. But more importantly, for Dan's sake, the agreement must legally state to whom and under what specific circumstances selling concessions may be allowed.
Right. They can't just do a handshake deal in the hallway. Larry can't just say, yeah, Dan, sell some shares and I'll toss you a few bucks later, depending on how I feel. It has to be in writing.
And this is disclosure inside the dealer agreements. It is inter-dealer documentation. It is not disclosure to the public retail investor.
Okay, let's hit our final direct question to the listener to test this exact concept. Pause and think. Dealer Dan opens the public prospectus that they hand out to retail investors. He wants to find out exactly how much concession commission he made per share on the AI Toast deal. Will he find his specific cut detailed in the public prospectus? Give it a beat.
Think about who sees what document.
Answer, no. The public prospectus only shows aggregate underwriting fees. It says something like, here is what the entire syndicate made in total. Dan's specific per share cut lives securely in his select and dealer's agreement.
The public investor never sees the inter-dealer concession table. Dan cannot rely on the prospectus to learn his own compensation. His only source of truth is the private contract he signed with Larry.
All right, brain reset. We have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the kitchen staff to the penalty box. Let's fire through a rapid recap of the absolute must-know Series 79 survival rules we just learned. Let's start with Rule 1.
Rule 1, the documents. The AAU equals the syndicate, which means several liability. You are legally responsible for your own pre-agreed share. The selected dealer's agreement equals the selling group, which means zero inventory risk. You are just a delivery driver.
Perfect. Rule 2. The commitments. Firm commitment means the underwriter takes principal risk. Best efforts means the underwriter acts as an agent with no inventory risk. And a standby commitment. Do not call it best efforts. That is a firm commitment backstop exclusively used for a rights offering.
Rule 3. Contingency offerings. Minimax and all-or-none deals trigger the strict escrow requirement with an unaffiliated bank to prevent commingling. A plain best efforts deal without a contingency still requires you to follow the investor payment rule, but it uses the promptly transmit path instead of forcing you into the formal escrow account.
Rule 4, Reg M and Tears. To get the light one-day restricted period, you need $100,000 ADTV and E, a $25 million public float. If you miss either threshold, you get bumped to the 5-day penalty box. And remember, issuers never ever get the actively traded free pass because they have absolute incentive to manipulate the stock.
And rule 5, lockups. Lockups are private commercial contracts between the underwriter and the insiders to prevent a supply flood. They are not SEC law. The only SEC rule regarding a lockup is that its terms must be transparently disclosed in the prospectus.
We did it. We survived the syndicate. We priced the AI toaster. And Frank is shopping for yachts.
If we connect all these individual rules back to the bigger picture, I want to leave you with a final thought to chew on as you continue studying. Think about the sheer undeniable power the lead manager holds in this entire ecosystem. Lead manager Larry isn't just a coordinator sending emails. He establishes the deal ID that tracks everything with FINRA. He holds the pen on the AAU. He's the one who decides if Frank gets a locked-up waiver to buy his yacht.
He truly is the puppet master of the whole operation.
Exactly. So when you're sitting there taking the Series 79, the clock is ticking and a question gets confusing, always take a breath and ask yourself, who is holding the ultimate power in this specific document? Follow the power, follow who is taking the financial risk, and you will almost always find the logical answer to the question.
Follow the power. I love that framework. You guys are going to absolutely crush this exam. Keep studying. Remember the difference between the kitchen staff and the delivery drivers. And whatever you do, don't let the SEC catch you commingling funds. We will see you on the next deep dive.